Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Mike Miles, the superintendent of Houston Independent School District, joins us to discuss the reforms he's implementing in the Lone Star State's largest district. Then on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study examining the effects of increased learning time on reading and math achievement. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Asking teachers that or parents that?
The AI robot that I'm going to send
it. Okay, got it.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Superintendent Mike Miles. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Superintendent Miles is superintendent of the Houston Independent School District, engaging in a massive turnaround of that massive school district. We're going to talk about that all in a moment. First, let me welcome in my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
All right. Well, Mike, it is great to see you again. I think the last time I saw you was in June at the 90th birthday party for Secretary of Education Rod Page, who is on our board. We're so proud of that. And what a milestone, and what an amazing room of luminaries that we got to enjoy.
Yeah, it certainly was. It was a good birthday party.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, we have had some discussion on the show before about what's been happening in Houston. We got a little bit of the background already on what led to the state taking over the school district. So we don't need to cover that, but we do want to know how things are going. So let's cover that in Ed Reform Update. All right. So please do tell us, Mike, you've got, all kinds of, we couldn't possibly cover all of the things that you and your team are up to down there trying to turn around the school system. But I do want to maybe zero in on what you're calling the new education system schools. Tell us what those are and what you are trying to do in that subset of schools to get better outcomes for kids in Houston.
Yeah, let me start by saying, you know, just like every large urban district, there are challenges with the current system. We can't keep doing the same things we've always done. And even those of us who've been in the reform work for quite some time, and Michael, you've been in it for quite some time, then you probably know that one of the challenges is doing piecemeal incremental reform. Superintendents usually do piecemeal reform because doing whole-scale reform is too difficult. And there's a lot of pushback even for one piece of reform. So we have an opportunity in Houston because we have a board of managers and because we have a really reform-minded team to do whole-scale systemic reform. That means doing lots of pieces of change at one time, changing how we staff schools, changing how we compensate teachers, changing how we do the instructional model, changing the curriculum, changing some of the experiences that kids get, changing the hours of the school day. That's a lot of change, changing the evaluation system, all of those things at one time, whole-scale systemic reform. I don't think any other district has ever tried this, but we started with 85 of our 274 schools this year underwent whole-scale systemic reform. Next year, we will add another 45 schools, bringing the total to 130 schools that are through which we will do whole-scale systemic reform. So that's about half the district next year will be in this new education system. In the meantime, we're not ignoring the rest of the district. So we're improving the quality of instruction. There are certain things that all schools have to do, regardless of whether they're NES or not, mostly related to good curriculum alignment, high quality instructional materials, and high quality instruction.
All right. Well, great. Well, you know, Mike, you are famous for your work in Dallas, where you saw some very impressive student achievement gains, especially with an innovative pay program. I was going to say pay for performance. It's more complicated than that, right? It was about getting highly effective teachers to sign up to go into some of the toughest schools and get paid extra, but also to serve in those tough schools and cohorts. You know, you had even before that, done some similar exciting work in Colorado Springs to that nature. So I am curious about the teacher pay piece. And it sounds like that's maybe is in the subset of schools to start with. You know, what is it that you're trying to do in order to reform the way the teachers are treated as professionals and they're compensated as professionals?
So we are going to move to a pay for performance system in the non-NES schools, not next year, but the year after. Next year, we'll spend time getting feedback and input from teachers and various stakeholder groups, and then we will implement that pay for performance plan in the 25-26 school year. In the meantime, we'll have 130 schools in the NES orbit, and those schools will be on a what we call a hospital model compensation plan. And what that does is it's a highly differentiated plan that pays language arts teachers more than math teachers. And those teachers get paid more than social studies teachers, who get paid more than elective teachers, et cetera. It's very differentiated. And the pay is tied to the position, not the teacher. So years of experience only matters a little bit up until the fourth year, and then it doesn't matter at all. But teachers also get paid for effectiveness. They get incentives. So their base salaries are about $15,000 to $20,000 more than the base salaries of the surrounding districts, and more than about $15,000 more than the non-NES step and lane salary schedule. So half the district teachers will be on this hospital model compensation plan next year. 85 schools are already on this hospital model. And so half the district will be making significantly more than the surrounding area.
Yeah, I love it. Now, in Dallas, I'm not sure if this happened under your watch or after you had left, but at some point, the district didn't have the money to continue that innovative pay program. We covered this on the show as well. And so, you know, that unfortunately, we lost a lot of the gains, right? The teachers ended up migrating back maybe to other schools. They weren't getting paid extra to stay in those schools. I guess the question... Go ahead and correct me if that's not.
Yeah, there's two things I think you may be conflating. One is Dallas did and does have a pay for performance plan.
Okay.
And that plan is still in effect.
All right.
And the teachers' salaries are higher in the Dallas district school district than the surrounding districts. What is true is that they had and still have some ACE schools. ACE is Accelerating Campus Excellence. Apart from the pay for performance plan, but connected to it, is that the teachers who were highly effective or distinguished were given an opportunity to move to the lowest performing schools, the F rated schools. And those teachers got an additional stipend of, I think, $10,000. And so when in some of those schools, when the ACE program stopped, you're right, the teachers left. The pay for performance didn't end, but that additional stipend ended, and that's when some of the teachers left. And yes, some of the schools, once ACE program ended, this is after my time there, reverted back and had a hard time achieving.
So that's the big question here, right? How do we create programs that can be sustainable? I mean, you've done this amazing work on you know, making these pay programs happen, but, you know, where do you find the money in Houston so that you can keep this going and potentially they can keep it going even after your time there is done?
Yeah. So one of the things we have to do is make sure that we have programs that can be sustained financially, and we build up a group of people that becomes a new status quo. Dallas has now had the pay for performance system since 2013. So over 10 years now, they've had the pay for, and we don't see it. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I don't think it's going to leave because so many teachers are now invested in it and the community's invested in it, and nobody wants to, you know, turn it around. We have to do the same thing in Houston. We have to have a period of time, several years, where we have this system in place. How do we find the money for it? I mean, I've already found money to raise salaries for half the district, which is 11,000 teachers. So about 5,500 teachers next year will have a base salary that's 15,000 to 20,000 more than the surrounding area. I already found the money for that because we stopped doing some things that we don't need to do. We prioritize the budget and we find efficiencies in central office and other areas to put the money into the classroom, into teacher salaries.
Wow. That's a lot of efficiencies. David, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I want to hear more about the career ladder. I'm perusing the website here as we speak, and I'm seeing it says hire additional apprentice teachers, which is music to my ears, right? Because one of the many things that frustrates me is the way we just throw people who really don't have the requisite experience in front of multiple classrooms worth of rowdy kids right from day one. And then, you know, your salary goes up and you eventually figure it out. But it's just, it's wholly different from the way research assistants or interns or basically, you know, starting employees are treated in almost any other industry that I can think of. So can you just describe that position and, you know, what are its responsibilities? How do you see it working? And yeah, how do you think it helps?
Yeah, and I'll try to be clear here about the paradigm shift in staffing. So the staffing model, and I'll get to your specific question, David, but I got to put in some kind of context. Staffing has been in the past, go out and recruit as many teachers as you can and try to retain as many of those teachers as you can. So it's about recruitment and retention. And everybody wants to start the year off with zero vacancies. And then as, you know, over time, if you get a vacancy during the year, more effective districts fill that vacancy faster than less effective districts. That's been the staffing paradigm, and you have, you know, 1 to 23 or 1 to 25 kids, et cetera. Our paradigm in the NES world is a little bit different. The paradigm is not about staffing or recruitment or retention, rather. It's more about making sure every kid has 180 student teacher contact days of high quality instruction. If that is your North Star, then you can't have substitutes. You can't have even an apprentice who's ineffective step in this class. You have to have good instruction on day one. I said 180 student teacher contact days of high quality instruction. So you would staff differently. You would also have the class prepared. So the curriculum's already designed. The lesson plans are already there. What we call the demonstrations of learning are already written. The answer keys are already made. So if an apprentice has to step in for a teacher who's absent, they already have the materials. They just have to teach well, and they're already part of the school. So in the NES world, we have teacher apprentices, and we have what we call learning coaches that support the teacher. The teacher doesn't have to do a lot. We're trying to strip away most of the stuff outside the classroom. So teachers don't even make copies. We have a copy center. Learning coaches take the copies to the copy center, bring them back, and provide them for the teacher. All the lesson plans are made ahead of time. Teachers do still have to internalize that lesson, but they get to, and they can tweak it and they can change it a little bit. But those are already provided. The demonstrations of learning are made, et cetera, et cetera. So we have not needed any substitutes in 85 schools in HISD this year. And we won't in 130 schools next year. And, you know, we have normal life, right? People do resign. People get sick. People go on vacation or use their PTO days. And still there are enough teacher apprentices and in some cases, learning coaches that can step in. And it's easier to step in because they've been in the school, they know the kids, and the lessons are already provided for them so they can just teach well.
Wow. There's so much more that we could ask you about, Mike. It's really exciting to hear about all of this. I do encourage folks to do what David did, which is to go look on your website and spend some time on those initiatives, and we'll be sure to include those links on our podcast page as well. But thank you so much for joining us. I hope maybe as you get further down the line with this process, we can have you back and get a progress report.
Yeah, happy to talk to you anytime, Michael.
All right, thanks so much. Again, Superintendent Mike Miles of the Houston Independent School District. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Woo. David and I just had an amazing talk with Mike Miles from Houston. He's an impressive guy.
Awesome. I need to go listen to it then.
I know. You know, I had the thought that I was like, ooh, it's kind of like I'm a journalist and I should be asking him tough questions. But you know what? I'm not a journalist.
And he gets plenty of tough questions from where I can sit and follow along.
Yeah.
Plenty of tough-minded answers, honestly, Mike. So
he's a tough-minded guy. So look, it gives you hope. And then you hear him and you think, wow, it just feels like night and day compared to what is happening in most big school districts today, you know, where this laser focus on achievement and on excellence and getting the best teachers into the neediest schools. Oh, just is wonderful. But it does not seem like something we see in many other places.
No. Well, and the incentives, I don't know. They're not there for those guys to really hold the line sometimes. But I bless him for trying. I we're cheering him on.
Governance matters, indeed. Okay. Well, what you got for us on the research front?
We've got a new descriptive study out by Matt Kraft and Sarah Novikoff. Examines how much time kids spend in school. This is kind of relevant right now. In the U.S. compared to internationally and within U.S. states. And then they do a little sort of cumulative look at what the best studies now have to say about time use, since we've, you know, had a generation here of much stronger studies than we used to have. So they identify and summarize findings from 74 U.S. studies that use credible designs such as RCTs, difference in differences, regression discontinuity, and so on. Those studies have to include effects on test scores, which is their primary measure. And then they look at what the research says about extending total time. And then they look at the differences in increasing that time as part of the school day or as part of the school year. So I'm going to go quickly through this since it's mostly the same pattern regarding total time. They find it has moderate to large effects, especially when it's part of a larger strategy to improve instructional quality. Like when you pair it with getting rid of underperforming teachers or increasing school level expenditures. Then when they look at extending the school year, they find small positive effects again in achievement in math and ELA from the addition of 10 or more extra days. So you kind of got to get to the 10 or more days point, it appears. And in terms of lengthening the school day, they see consistent positive effects of small to medium magnitude on student achievement. The overall pattern is consistent with positive but marginally decreasing returns to additional time during the school day. Obviously, you get larger increases in time when systems have fewer total hours. You're going to get the bigger bang for your buck. 4-day weeks, bad news. We've heard that before. And starting earlier in the day, more positive effects, which I think we've heard of that research as well. I mean, sorry, starting later in the day. I know. I get the quizzical look starting later in the day. They used data collected in 2021 by the OECD. So now they're going to look across OECD countries. Elementary schools in the U.S. are on average providing 1,022 more hours of instructional time across 180 days per year. That equates to 5.7 hours per day, which seemed kind of low to me, 5.7 hours per day. But that ranked us near the top of the distribution of instructional time. We were 8th among 37 countries. And they dig in and they say, okay, we achieved this ranking through a combination of a relatively long school day. We're ranked 8th there, but we have a short school year compared to other countries. We're ranked 24th there. 15 countries have school calendars that are at least 2 weeks longer than the average 180 days in the U.S. Those that have more days are, let's see, Spain, Greece, and France. All right, now we're going to dig deeper in the U.S. As of February 2023, 16 states mandate both the length of the school year and the amount of total hours. 10 states give districts freedom to meet either a minimum number of days or total hours requirement. 11 states require only a minimum number of days. 13 set a minimum requirement for the number of total hours. Oh, it's all over the place. Obviously results in vastly different minimum school time requirements based on where kids live. Among the 37 states that identify a minimum number of days, the majority again set it at 180, but it ranges between a low of 160 in Colorado. They're kind of laid back in Colorado sometimes, to a high of 186 in Kansas. 39 states specify minimum number of hours per year. High school hours range from 720 in Arizona to 1,260 in Texas. High school kids in Alabama, Florida, and Connecticut are required to have 900 hours of school per year, while their peers in Maryland, okay, maybe Checker had something to do with this, Maryland kids have to have 1,170 hours. So students attending schools at the 90th percentile of the distribution of the number of hours per day are in school more than an hour longer each day than the kids at the 10th percentile. Schools at the 90th percentile for the number of days per year are in session two weeks more than schools at the 90th percentile. And then cumulative, when they look at the total number of school hours per year, that differs by almost 200 hours between schools at the 90th and 10th percentiles. And that gap equates to approximately a difference of 5.5 weeks of schooling. And then if you're looking across entire K-12 education, that's a difference of about more than two full school years in some cases. Anyway, then they had this whole section on raising the minimum school requirements. You know, maybe policymakers want to look into that. But given that we've got this research showing diminishing returns, maybe we need to be focusing on the schools and districts that offer the least amount of time to get more, the biggest bang for our time buck.
Woo. Wow. Well, look, I think the overall findings are compelling. Time matters. This is not new, but it sounds like the research continues to add up. You know, all this data about how much time kids are in school, I have to admit, as a parent, I'm a little suspicious about how this plays out on the ground. I mean, I don't know. Montgomery County Public Schools finds many, many ways to shrink the amount of instructional time. You know, we've got half days here and half days there and, you know, snow days and rain days and wind days and PD days. And then, you know, guess what? At the end of each semester, there's several days of kids watching movies all day long.
Yes. Well, it doesn't equal, sorry for talking over you, but that was one of the main points that I didn't make in my summary, which is that they do make that distinction that just because it's on the books doesn't mean it's actual instructional time because of all of these interruptions and half days and so on and so forth. So very good point. I'm sure Matt Kraft would agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, look, highly effective people and organizations in any sector, in any nation, make really good use of time, right? And so, you know, that counts for schools too, and the amount of time and then making good use of it, which does not mean that you're constantly hammer away. I mean, you know, you've got to think about pacing and you've got to think about, I would love, if I had to have one measure, a subjective qualitative measure of schools, you know, I think asking, hey, does this school make good use of kids' time would be a pretty good one.
Asking teachers that or parents that?
Experts to go in and judge, or, you know, the AI robot that I'm going to send it.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. This is an overtasked robot, folks. Okay, I have a question and sort of a statement, right? Which is, I was listening carefully to try to understand if the researchers think we are closer to sort of the zone of reasonableness when it comes to the number of days or the number of hours in a day, right? And based on the international comparisons, right, just based on sort of the wisdom of crowds or whatever, right, it sounds like we are perhaps more, I guess, lax or unreasonable when it comes to the number of days.
That's right.
Okay. Is there any empirical, does the empirical research actually back up the notion that the school day is long enough and the issue is that we don't have enough school days? Or is that, we did not say that?
It does not ask the question that way. But right, compared to, you know, that bit where I told you about, you know, where we're eighth in the school day, but we're 24th for the school year. So, right, we're not having kids in school as long as some other, you know, quote, higher performing countries. But again, this is not causal stuff here.
Okay. Well, in that case, let me just offer my non-research-based opinion, right? Which is, I'm actually not that up in arms about the number of hours that kids are in school for the reasons that Mike articulated, right? Which is, it, what really counts is how you're using the time, right? People are not robots, and no grad student that I have ever encountered can actually make it through a 3-hour, evening seminar without stifling a yawn, right? Like, even adults can't do it all the time, every day, minute after minute, hour after hour, just maxing it out. And so my just gut instinct, right, is that we'd all be better served if we had, you know, added 50 days to the school year and started the day at 10 o'clock and ended it at 2 or whatever. I mean, you pick your distribution, right? But it just seems to me that the way human beings work is not to slave away for 7 or 8 hours a day, focusing every second of the day, and then take 3.5 months off or whatever it is, right? To forget all their math. Like, that just isn't my experience of how kids work, right? At any age, it's not even how adults work. And I guess I just feel like my opinion is that, you know, superintendents or whoever's on the other side of the negotiating table, redistributing those hours could be a really good use of, you know, sort of political capital. I'm sorry the research doesn't back me up, but that's how I feel.
Yeah. I mean, but ironically, when the research we have on year-round schooling, which isn't a lot, when we give kids like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off in the summer, it's not giving us a strong signal. So I don't know. That makes me wonder too, because when schools and districts are brave enough to try year-round schooling, we don't have the research to back that either. But when we give kids a double block of ELA, hey, they do a lot better in ELA. So, you know, that seems to matter when we double up. So I don't know. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well said, gang. But speaking of time, we are out of time. That's all the time we got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.